Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hot Libya, hot reactors in Japan, and hot negotiations in Washington this week over federal spending. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates testified before the House Armed Services Committee yesterday. He promised no U.S. ground troops for Libya.
I can't speak to any CIA activities, but I will tell you that the president has been quite clear that in terms of the United States military, there will be no boots on the ground.
Offstage budget negotiations this week heating up toward a shutdown deadline. Situation intense. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
There's no agreement on numbers, and nothing will be agreed to until everything is agreed to.
And new apologies as Japan struggles with the stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Here's the chairman of Tokyo Electric Power Company, Tsunehisa Katsumata.
We want to apologize from the bottom of our hearts for the fact that the effects of this serious accident have spread to the atmosphere, waterways, farm products, and drinking water, and have caused worry and inconvenience to all members of the public.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Chrystia Freeland of Reuters, Jill Doherty of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Do you understand the plan for Libya? Are we headed in or out? Will Japan's nuclear crisis become our own? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Jill Doherty, it's great to have you back with us. Thanks very much.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be here.
Chrystia Freeland, welcome back to you as well.
Pleasure.
And hello, Jack. I want to dive right in, Jack, Chrystia, Jill, if I may, with the president, a little bit of the president's speech early in the week, somewhat a week or 10 days into the no-fly zone over Libya. He came before the American people at the National Defense University in Washington to talk about the situation in Libya, explaining his version of why he thought it was necessary to intervene.
To brush aside America's responsibility as a leader, and more profoundly, our responsibilities to our fellow human beings under such circumstances would have been a betrayal of who we are. Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action.
That was early in the week. President Obama's version of American exceptionalism may be there, Jill. The United States of America is different. Here we are at the end of this week. When he was speaking, the rebels were riding high and seemed to be on a tear toward Tripoli. Since then, they've been turned around, headed back the other way. All kinds of testimony and kind of conflicting signals. Some might think, Jill, about where the U.S. is headed here. No boots on the ground, says Robert Gates, but the CIA is already there. What's the situation, Jill?
Well, you know, that is the quandary right now, because on the ground you have the rebels in retreat, or at least stymied by the government forces. And then you have this, the ostensible reason for this, and it's not just ostensible, there's a UN resolution mm-hmm. to the effect that this is to protect civilians, protect people from being murdered by the government. But you, at the same time, have the president and members of his administration saying that the ultimate goal is to get rid of Gaddafi. And so those two, right from the beginning, have been in conflict, or at least seemingly not easy to put together. And the ultimate problem, I think, is that how do you stop people from being killed if Gaddafi, who continues to order his troops to attack, is still in power? That's a dilemma.
Yeah, there's talk of, I mean, more than talk, of defections around him. Musa Kusa, prominent senior Libyan official, well-known to many foreign diplomats, off to London this week, out of Gaddafi's inner circle, it appears. Here's the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, saying that that is a signal that Gaddafi's leadership is faltering.
His resignation shows that Gaddafi's regime, which has already seen significant defections to the opposition, is fragmented, under pressure, and crumbling from within.
So says the British Foreign Secretary, but is that so clear, Jill, that it's crumbling from within? Others say he's not really the inner circle, not Gaddafi's tribe, not Gaddafi's family.
But he is somebody who was with him right from the beginning, you know, going back years and years ago. And he did have, we understand, a falling out with one of his sons about a year ago. But he's very well plugged in. He was the intelligence chief. He knows a lot of things. He could be very helpful to the West. But that's not, it's no, not only Moussa Koussa. Also, we have the news that the choice, Libya's choice for UN representative now has turned over. He is leaving. There are other soundings that some others may leave. And then you have these indications, everything is very murky, mm-hmm. but that there might be some way of having a transition to Gaddafi's son, Mutasim, his national security advisor.
Would that satisfy the rebels? That doesn't sound like necessarily much of a change.
No, it doesn't, because it's very much a family business in control of Libya. Then you have other indications that, well, gee, maybe he could go into exile. That would be Gaddafi himself. That raises all sorts of issues. Where does he go? He could be indicted by the International Criminal Court. Do you just let him go? Do you let him go to a country where they can't get him? But the whole hope of this administration at this point is to try to use everything possible to splinter his government, to crack it open, and have anybody who is with him right now get the picture that now's the time to get out. And then what's left would be Gaddafi, and they argue that would be, of course, much easier. But he's a very unpredictable leader.
All kinds of political response to this week, and a wide range in our own of feedback from our listeners here on Facebook. Y says, I think everyone understands the real goal is to topple Gaddafi. He says, I say support the Libyan people to oust old Muammar, if we can get that done with enough weapons and a little advice. But then we've got William saying no to arming the rebels in Libya. Why are people rushing into this? Interesting commentary across the spectrum here. Republicans, Tea Party people, Democrats. Here's Michelle Bachmann, who chairs the House Tea Party Caucus, saying she's very wary of America's involvement in Libya.
How in the world are they going to reach their ultimate military objectives if there aren't boots on the ground? I don't want to see U.S. boots on the ground. I don't want to see United States arms. I don't want to see United States involvement at all in Libya.
But here's Republican Dana Rohrabacher, Republican California, saying that he's supporting Obama for the way he's handled the situation so far.
I have, from day one, given this administration fairly high marks on the way it's handled this crisis. I'm not like the Republicans who are just seeking a way to be critical of President Obama.
Christian Freeland, what do you see going on here? The U.S. has been very clear that it wants others to bear a lot of this burden. Is it clear that if the United States steps out, and we hear the Pentagon saying this morning, we're out of there, we're handing it over to NATO at some level anyway, is Europe ready, do you think, Christy, to step up and see this thing through?
Well, the French have certainly been very actively involved. Canada has been involved, too. So this isn't just about American exceptionalism. And mm-hmm. I thought the president's comments about not wanting to stand aside while there was slaughter were very powerful. But it's not only America that feels that way right now. Other point that I just wanted to bring into the conversation when it comes to why I personally think it was absolutely right to take this action in Libya is the demonstration effect to the rest of the region and the rest of the world. If Gaddafi were to have easily suppressed the opposition without any meaningful reaction from the rest of the world, then I think you draw a very, very simple lesson if you are a dictator, which is Mubarak made a mistake, Gaddafi did the right thing. And actually, there is no cost to shooting your own people. We still are living in a world with a lot of authoritarian regimes where the Arab Spring has inspired a lot of people to try to live a better life, to try to be free. That is so great. And if the world stands by and says, well, you know, actually, the right policy from the self-interested point of view of an authoritarian ruler is just keep on killing your people. There are going to be no consequences for that. It has an impact far beyond Libya's borders.
Big demonstrations in Yemen again today, all week in Syria. We've seen all kinds of turmoil there. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was before that House committee yesterday, but he was talking already limits to the depth of American involvement, saying others can get involved here.
The United States is in support of others. and others have been taking a much more aggressive stance in that respect, if you will. And my view would be, if there is going to be that kind of assistance to the opposition, there are plenty of sources for it other than the United States.
Jack Beatty, plenty of other sources for support here. No boots on the ground. On the other hand, we read from a number of sources this week, CIA already there. So are we headed in or out, Jack?
Well, you know, Tom, it's been a week of vertiginous developments. We've gone from moral clarity, the president's soaring rhetoric, to the fog of war, literally the fog of war. Admiral Mullen says that it's cloud cover that has allowed Gaddafi to make the progress he's had in the last couple of days. The allies simply can't get at his forces. But the fog is even broader. I mean, on the one hand, we're bombing Gaddafi. Now NATO has warned the opposition that if they shoot on civilians, and there have been some reports of that, they will be bombed.
Oh boy.
NATO says no to arms for the rebels. The Brits are saying, well, perhaps we should have them, and the U.S. equivocal. We say we don't have the goal of the military operation is not regime change. But Secretary Gates says we're going to wear down his forces to the point where the army will have to choose be destroyed or topple Gaddafi. Therefore, we will have regime change. The GOP, some are saying Buck McKeon, for example, the chairman of the House committee, saying we're doing too much. John McCain on the Senate committee, we're doing too little. The fog of war has closed in.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at a week in the news, mayhem over Libya, radioactive waters in Japan, milk in California, 1 week to a shutdown deadline in Washington on the federal budget. Krista Freeland joins us this hour, global editor-at-large for Reuters. She's with us from New York. Jill Doherty is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN out of Washington. Jack Beatty's here. Jack talking there about John McCain going after the president for not being there when the chips are down, he's saying. Here's Republican Senator John McCain.
The U.S. military will no longer be flying strike sorties against Gaddafi's armored columns and ground forces. I believe this would be a profound mistake with potentially disastrous consequences.
The president getting it from all sides as Washington, along with NATO, looks for the way forward in Libya. Let's hear from our listeners. Paul in White River Junction, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think it's about time that Congress strongly reasserted its war powers, constitutional rights. The president seems to be to think, and past presidents seem to think, that they can enter into war and without any congressional approval or advice. I think Congress needs to say war is any time we take military action, and we no longer want the president to engage in military action without our approval. Thank you.
Paul, thank you very much. Jill Doherty, I mean, a lot of people looked up a week and more ago now, you know, U.S. planes flying, bombs falling. Nothing really from Congress, just an executive decision. And once again, people say, where's Congress in this? It comes up every time, which seems to be frequently in recent years. And yet it's always presidents rolling straight ahead with the jets and bombs.
Exactly. And in this situation, the president would argue that it's not really war. This is carrying out a UN resolution, which the primary purpose of which is to protect civilians. So it's not like declaring war on another country. It is carrying out this resolution. And he would argue quite defined, although obviously very few people really buy that, but with a defined purpose. But I think one of the problems, Tom, is that when you talk about civilians, yes, in the beginning, if you took this as part of the Arab Spring and you said, here are these people on the streets, they're demonstrating, and it sounds very civilian. But what this has morphed into is a fight by rebels against the central government, a government which we don't really like that much. And so it's turned into a warlike situation as opposed to just kind of protecting civilians. It is both, but it's also this armed conflict.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, bombs raining down, lots of fire on the ground that we've seen, and this debate, and I wonder if you can shed any light on it, Jill, about this is on the, you know, whether or not it's war and how deeply we get involved. The debate within the administration we're reading about whether or not to arm rebels. Now, Jack points out the British have sounded maybe open to that. Washington, it's been a little more obscure. People have said no, but then others appear to be pushing forward. And if the CIA is already there, who knows? What can you tell us, Jill, about that debate in Washington?
Well, one of the reasons that there is this debate is that they continue to say, and I think it's probably legitimate, that they don't totally know exactly who the opposition are. I mean, we know some of the leaders, you know, Mr. Jalil, Secretary Clinton has met with him twice. They know quite a few people. They're, many of them are members of the, or former members of the Gaddafi group, in fact. But what do they ultimately want? Could there be, you know, as some have said, a slight connection to al-Qaeda, perhaps former al-Qaeda? That seems not to be a big factor. But what do they ultimately want? And you just look back at the red flags from arming, going back to the 1980s, arming the Mujahideen against the Soviets. And look what happened. Osama bin Laden. You know, you look at Iraq, there are many examples that once you start getting those weapons out there, you're never quite sure where they're going to end up or whether they will be used against you or whether it could just turn into a bloodbath.
Of course, Defense Secretary Robert Gates in the 80s was a CIA official himself. He funneled weapons to the Mujahideen that ousted the Soviets in Kabul and then turned around to end up fighting with a lot of them, who became Taliban later. Christian Freeland, if this is a signal gesture by the world to say we support the Arab Spring, does that mean it has to go all the way, even to supplying arms to the rebels, Christian, to make that support real?
No, absolutely not. And actually, what I was trying to say was that this is a gesture to say it's not going to be a smart strategy for dictators to massacre their own people to maintain power. And, you know, if you think about Libya, what we do know is that Gaddafi is an autocratic ruler, a dictator willing to kill his own people massively to stay in power. And I think that we can be pretty clear without any fog of war or any ambiguity that that is a bad thing. And it's a bad thing for there to be other leaders in other countries who think that that's a good strategy. And we see a lot of them inspired partly by Gaddafi. So,
but how far do you have to go to make that point, Christian? I mean, they've come in, they've done the no-fly zone, but he may still be winning. The rebels are asking for a ceasefire now. I'm not even sure what that would mean. But, you know, is success required to make that statement of support complete? If Gaddafi still wins, does it augur the other way?
If Gaddafi's, I mean, I think, you know, what we're talking about is, was the no-fly zone, is this air cover better than not having air cover? Because those are the two alternatives, right? And I think in that case, it's absolutely clear that this is better. And I think that it's quite right for there to be a little bit of hesitation and caution and thoughtfulness on the part of the Western governments that are intervening to see what happens. Because clearly the preferred outcome would be for Gaddafi to fall without more Western involvement than we've had so far. It would have been better if the rebels had been able to win without us helping them at all. So, and I think we need to also remember that this is a very quickly changing situation. I think that the defections at the top are really significant because that is one of, you know, the key moments that you see a regime is about to fall. Those people close to Gaddafi are the ones who have much more information than any of us about the likelihood of success. And if they think that it's smarter for them to get out, that to me is much more significant than, you know, what happens in this very shifting battlefront.
Let's get a call from Rugby, Tennessee. Terry's calling. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. We've helped Gaddafi for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And if we don't help the rebels in some way, now we can facilitate them getting weapons without us sending them, something of that order.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't help the people that he has oppressed, then that just says that we're still on his side, oppressing people.
So you're for it. Figure out a way to help the rebels.
Yes, sir. And by the way, to John Boehner, I'd like to know where are all those jobs they promised 10 years ago?
Terry, we got it. We'll keep that ledger open. We'll keep watching. Jack, their support. I mean, I helped Gaddafi for 40 years. I don't know. We fought with Gaddafi as well. We tried to bomb and kill Gaddafi in the Reagan years. Have worked some with Libya more recently. Where do you see this going, Jack? There's so many moving pieces. As Christia says here, we may never. If they end up with more arms, we may never know exactly who supplied them, I suppose.
Indeed, and it's hard to see how you avoid a stalemate. And Secretary Gates was asked about this, and his answer, as I said earlier, was, well, we'll wear down his forces to the point where there'll be a kind of coup. They'll decide to do that. But look what he's already doing tactically to respond to that. He's mixing his forces with people in the cities, meaning they can't be touched from above. Also, what will happen in a stalemate? Well, the CIA gave a confidential briefing to the Senate the other day. Diane Feinstein said that leaked some of it, which was that his forces are killing, quote, significant numbers of people in the towns that his forces have reoccupied. So stalemate means sort of small-scale massacre. On the other hand, if the rebels are armed, it's going to take time to show them how to use anti-tank weapons. I've read it could take a month or more. How do they sustain themselves in the meantime? It's all at this level. It's all very murky indeed, even morally murky. I mean, you know, do we dare go after his forces inside the cities and risk civilian casualties? All these questions are out there.
Meanwhile, still playing.
I guess my question, could I just jump in quickly? My question for Jack is, would it be better, Jack, for us not to be having this no-fly zone? I mean, would Gaddafi not be killing all these people?
No, listen, I think it's great that we're doing it, and I'm glad we are. But I just think once you get down from the level of let's do this wonderful humanitarian thing to the level of, well, how is it all going to work out? All these questions arrive, and you're back into ambiguity just inevitably.
I want to look across the region, if we may, because this is not the only scene where there's a lot going on. Yemen, as I said, huge turnout today to protest against the regime there. Syria, where you just don't see this kind of thing, in the last couple of weeks has really exploded. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, came out this week very tough, claiming that recent protests were the work of external forces.
Our enemies are doing on a daily basis to attack and sabotage the stability of Syria. We agree that they are very clever in choosing these most sophisticated means to do so, but they are stupid as well because they have chosen the wrong nation and the wrong people.
They're picking on the wrong nation, the wrong people. Jill Doherty, what about the great unraveling of the status quo that we saw in Egypt and Tunis? Is it still going on? Are we still seeing the unraveling in Yemen and Syria?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, one could question when will we see the end of it, because there are so many ramifications. I mean, just look at Syria, the connections with Iran in Syria. Syria is a big, sophisticated country, and it's got a lot of moving parts to it, much more, I think you'd have to say, than Libya. And then Yemen. You know, there is a dilemma. You have these really violent demonstrations against President Saleh, who happens to be really an ally of the United States. I mean, ally not like Great Britain, but certainly a person who was fighting al-Qaeda, fighting, you know, an ally in the war on terror. And that was one of the problems. The narrative just before all of this began was, in fact, we were there with Secretary Clinton. One of the things was, this is the leader of a country who is fighting al-Qaeda, and that al-Qaeda is the danger in Yemen. So each of these countries has very serious ramifications. In and of itself, it might not be, you know, that important. Is Libya really that important? That's another debate. Is Libya really that important? Maybe not. But what happens now really is in the context of this Arab Spring that combines so many different countries.
Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and Alan. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Just a quick point. I hear the term Congress thrown around a little bit, and so the point I just wanted to make was, when I think of the Congress, I think of the Senate and the House. And so with the Senate passing the resolution that it did in agreement with the UN Security Council's resolution there, I think it's a little bit of an untrue statement or an incomplete statement to say that Congress hadn't been notified or kind of filled in. if the House chose not to pass anything, then that's the House's provision. But to say that Congress as a whole hasn't been involved in this process, I think is a little bit of that's a little bit of an untrue statement.
Well, I mean, the White House says there were briefings, but there was no declaration of war, that's for sure, and many in Congress complaining, many high-level people in Congress complaining they weren't adequately briefed. Of course, this is the pattern we see again and again, confusion and complaint over just that point, but meanwhile, the jets are in the air. I want to turn to Japan, if we may, and that ongoing struggle there, just heartrending. Reports of those 50 or more Japanese workers in and around the Fukushima Daiichi plant, many of them now expecting they will die from radiation exposure, relatives are saying, and that radiation seeping into groundwater, into the seas off Japan, even showing up after cows munch on pastures in the United States, in American milk. Not at dangerous levels, we're told now. Nevertheless, it's arresting to see just how all that moves. Here's Japanese Cabinet Officer Yukio Edano talking about a timetable for the return of evacuees to the area surrounding the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
We need to regain the control of the nuclear power plant, and whether or not we can do that, or the time frame may change depending on the development of the nuclear plant, and we are trying to regain control as soon as possible.
As soon as possible, but it is still a very serious situation there. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, saying this week that plant situation remains deadly serious.
The situation continues to be very serious. And the efforts to overcome this crisis is increasing. At the same time, they encounter difficulties like the existence of water or high level of radiation.
Jill Doherty, we've had all kinds of conflicting numbers coming out this week. Tokyo Electric Power Company putting out some huge radiation readings and then backtracking a couple of times here. Clearly, though, a lot of trouble still at that plant. Do you have a sense, Jill, whether or not they are getting on top of this or still wrestling right at the brink of a meltdown?
That's very hard to evaluate. I mean, the last I heard was there was a little glimmer of hope, but one of the problems has been exactly what you're talking about, TEPCO coming out with figures that are incorrect or lack of information, and people not really trusting what they're saying. So evaluating it is very difficult. And then you have the numbers of people who have been killed. Then you have the numbers of people who have been displaced. Hmm. And then overriding this, I was talking to one senior administration official, you know, it's the economic situation too. Don't forget, before all this started, Japan had some great, you know, really serious economic difficulties. And this is going to be enormously expensive, not only humanly, but economically.
Christian, the whole world reminded of the threat if and when things go wrong. I mean, that map of the United States now, it looks like a third or half the states in the country where some evidence of the radioactive effusion from Japan now in evidence in the United States, not at dangerous levels, we're told, but if it goes to a meltdown, you get plutonium up in the jet stream. This is not fun to watch, Christian.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, we and, you know, to take the economic aspects of what is, you know, first and foremost a really dreadful human tragedy, mm-hmm. I think that one of the really big ones in the long term is going to be the impact this has on the world's appetite for nuclear power. And if you remember before the earthquake, it was a moment where I was certainly seeing the beginnings of a nuclear renaissance. You had the combination of oil becoming expensive, oil supplies uncertain, oil seeming to run out, plus our concerns about climate change. And suddenly a lot of people were starting to say, well, you know what, maybe nuclear power is actually not only a green solution, a renewable solution. Mm-hmm. I think that nuclear renaissance is now absolutely over. And we just seem to be getting more and more bad news from Japan. I think that is going to have huge implications for energy sources in the future.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after a week-long search, the Bronx Zoo's missing Egyptian cobra was finally found yesterday. Slithering around the reptile house, Zoo Director Jeremy Brahini describes how they recovered the missing snake.
We wanted to create an environment where the snake felt comfortable coming out, so we kept the lights dim and we tried to keep as much noise and commotion down so she would feel comfortable coming out.
Seven New York State workers hit it big this week, winning a $319 million lottery jackpot. Too bad for their co-workers who, oops, didn't kick in this week. One of the lucky winners explains how the office pool worked.
We have a list that we have every time we have a drawing, and if you get in, we mark in. If you don't get in, we just put a line through your name and you're out.
And the nation's first female vice presidential candidate, Geraldine Ferraro, has died at 75. Here she is at the historic 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco.
My fellow citizens, I proudly accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
We're looking at a week in the news, mayhem over Libya, radioactive waters in Japan, milk in California, 1 week to a shutdown deadline on the budget in Washington. Chrystia Freeland is with us from Reuters. Jill Doherty, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a call from Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Beth. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very busy week, huh?
Yeah, no kidding.
My question may not necessarily help the present situation in Tokyo with the nuclear reactor, but I'm curious if there isn't some way that a shutdown procedure could be stationed perhaps off-site in the future when they build another one, because we have seven nuclear power plants in the state of South Carolina. So this makes me extremely nervous, and I'm wondering if there couldn't be some way to have them shut down off-site to not have to endanger the lives of those that have to go in after an event like this.
Beth, we'll pick it up. We're not nuclear engineers here, but Chrystia Freeland, there has been a lot of talk about nuclear design since Japan's problem erupted here. Now, you know, once nuclear meltdown or hot rods get going, it's not easy to do anything from off-site, we're seeing. I mean, what happens right there seems to be the issue. But what about alternative designs, Chrystia? Is there a real case being made out there for, some real alternative that would not even risk the kind of situation we're seeing in Japan, do you know?
Well, I think overall right now we are still collectively in a state, you know, the people who manage money, the people who make political decisions, and the people who make engineering decisions are all still trying to figure out what is actually going to happen in Japan before taking the next steps. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing the political consequences. You know, we've seen it in a recent election in Germany, nuclear power all of a sudden becoming a huge issue. So I don't think we're there yet. I do think that the Japanese disaster should give us particular pause because this isn't Chernobyl. You know, we thought, and I think rightly, the Japanese are good at technology. So,
I mean, it isn't Chernobyl in that it isn't in the former Soviet Union. This is supposed
right.
to be a world technology leader.
Right. I don't think that we were that surprised. And I've been to Chernobyl several times. I don't think that we were that surprised that the Soviets had built a reactor that, you know, wasn't in that great shape. But I think we have higher expectations, quite rightly, of the level of technological competence of the Japanese. The other area that I think that people are looking at very carefully right now is, you know, the obvious geological vulnerability of nuclear reactors. And California is one of the places which is potentially in trouble there. The difficulty is, you know, once you've built a nuclear reactor, it's pretty hard to just shut it down and move it.
And we have a lot in this country already, not the same dependence as Japan, but lots. President Obama talking about energy this week. His focus was not nuclear, but oil, setting out a goal for the U.S. to cut way back on oil and in a pretty big hurry. Here he is at a speech at Georgetown University in Washington on Wednesday.
There are no quick fixes. Anybody who tells you otherwise isn't telling you the truth. And we will keep on being a victim to shifts in the oil market until we finally get serious about a long-term policy for a secure, affordable energy future.
Jack Beatty, do you see that change in Washington as we watch the nukes, you know, teetering in Japan and all the concern Chris is talking about? Do you see a real new energy policy emerging in Washington?
Well, I think the president was that was really a political speech, as I see it. He was trying to inoculate himself against the likelihood, or at least the possibility, of $4 a gallon gasoline. He wants to be seen to be,
by saying,
I'm doing
drill, baby, drill, almost,
or I'm doing something about this. And he made a disingenuous claim. He said, you know, last year we had less. Imported oil than any time in the last X years. Well, of course, there's a reason for that. The economy has slowed down, and in fact, the administration's own projections are that foreign imports are going to increase this year. So he's down to that kind of lawyering in order to make things look good. His outlook seems to be the right one. We have to have a mix. He's eclectic, and his budget does include, I think, $30 or more billion in loan guarantees for nuclear. And the Republicans continue to say, hey, we like that. We're going to go ahead with that. There are 20-odd licenses out there being talked about. And so at least at that official level, Khrushchev's reaction hasn't set in. It may, from the public. There's been a 20-point loss just in the last month in public support for nuclear power. The administration is trying to combat that. They had the director of the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission testifying, and he was I won't say complacent, but reassuring about the safety of U.S. plants, pointing to differences. For example, we have radiation-hardened robots that, if people can't get into these plants to fix things and to prevent the rods from melting down or whatever it is, the robots can't. So on and on.
Japanese aren't too bad at robots themselves. The president's saying he wants to cut crude oil imports one-third by the year 2025. Christopher Freeland, is that window dressing? Every president since maybe Richard Nixon has had some kind of goal like that. Do you see President Obama and Congress really heading toward some kind of track that could make that real?
Well, I think there are a few tracks that could make that real. I think one of the most likely, which will make people concerned about the environment crazy, is I think we're going to see a real renewed interest in coal. America has coal. Coal is not that expensive. And the big downside of coal has been the environmental impact. But I think that we're going to see coal look a lot more appealing and start playing a bigger role in a lot of countries' energy mix.
Is that a failure or a success? I mean, coal is the big dirty if you don't do it in some way that's scarcely been done yet.
Right. But coal doesn't have, you know, the big monster dangers that we're now seeing around nuclear power. And I am now being predictive rather than sort of expressing my own personal mm-hmm. views. And coal would be a way of lessening dependence on oil. I think you are going to see, as you were saying, Tom, you know, a little bit more of a drill, baby, drill attitude. And then the final thing that the president could do, you know, when we talk about dependence on oil, part of that is using a lot of it. And the best, smartest, most effective, easiest way of getting people to use less is to tax gasoline. But that really seems to be the third rail of American politics.
Jill Doherty talking about moving the goalposts. So global warming doesn't look so bad because it's better than nuclear meltdown?
You know, I think one thing they're going to have to do, though, in this debate, when things do get a little bit quieter, if they ever do, on Japan, is to analyze why that actually happened, you know, the nuclear meltdown, or whatever we want to call mm-hmm. it. Because I'm not a scientist, and I was not very good in chemistry in high school either. So, but I understand that it was essentially the tsunami that swamped the pumps that pumped water to keep it cool. So if you're talking about the technology per se, of nuclear technology, that's kind of a different issue. So there may be ways, at least, let's say scientifically, that the argument could still be made for nuclear power. But the problem is, you know, publicly, it is so scary that people, I think, are going to tune out, and no matter how they technically explain anything, a lot of people will be scared by what happened. But nevertheless, this administration continues to say that it is part of the portfolio of energy that they want to use.
As we all stare at the unknowns that just cannot be planned for and can have consequences so big for Japan, and maybe, if they don't get a handle on this, for the world, I want to turn to the big budget debate, kind of just under the covers here, but going to burst out for sure next week as we approach this next deadline for a potential government shutdown. Lots of to-ing and fro-ing between Republicans and Democrats and everybody in the Tea Party, Vice President Biden in there. Here on Tuesday in Washington, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said negotiations on the budget are being hampered by a split within the Republican Party.
The infighting between the Tea Party and the rest of the Republican Party, including the Republican leadership in Congress, is keeping our negotiating partner from the negotiating table. And it's pretty hard to negotiate without someone on the other side of the table to talk to.
Well, they've got someone, Jack Beatty. They've got more than someone. They've got the Republican leadership. They've got Tea Party leadership and still a very ardent pursuit of that big, big budget cut this year on the Tea Party part, at least. What's unfolding here, Jack? Are we headed for a government shutdown, for a huge cut to something else? What?
Well, the Tea Party rally yesterday on Capitol Hill, Kathy Durr of the Tea Party Patriots laid it right on the line to the Republican leadership. She said, and I quote, "I say to the Republican leadership, take off your lace panties."
Oh, jeez.
Well, there it is. The thought of that is enough to make me go for a balanced budget. There are two things in play here. There's the money, and as Speaker Boehner has hinted, the riders. And the riders include eliminating funding for Planned Parenthood, rolling back EPA substantially, funding, for example, to implement the greenhouse gas rules, curb mercury emissions, limit mountaintop removal mining.
All that to go.
That's all to go.
And these are riders, Jack, on the deal that they're putting together? It's the deal and the whole deal, as John Boehner said at the top, or nothing?
The Republicans want these riders, or at least some of them, to survive. And one of them, of course, is eliminating funding for NPR.
Oh.
And that's all in the mix. And I guess the logic is the higher the number they agree on, the cut, and speculation has been $33 billion. The higher the number, the less they'll need to agree on the riders. But conversely, if the number, the riders have to compensate if the Democrats won't meet the Republicans on a high number. So a lot of things are just in the air. And John Boehner, he's got pressure behind him, and he's got even Eric Cantor sort of looking over his shoulder, and maybe even a hint there of some kind of leadership coup, or at least people have mentioned that, if Boehner doesn't deliver. On the other hand, $33 billion, if that is the deal, would be the biggest single cut in many years, and would be a Republican achievement. Now, would it be good for the economy? Well, we had Goldman Sachs predicting that the whole cut, $61 billion, would slow down economic growth. You had Mark Zandi saying it would result in 400,000 fewer jobs by 2011. Well, does that mean 200,000 jobs will be lost? It's not going to be good for economic growth no matter what happens.
Formal showdown on the shutdown coming up right in front of us next week. That pressure really on Republicans as the Tea Party going for the bigger, bigger, bigger cuts. Here's a Republican Senator John Cornyn on MSNBC saying he wished that there was an effort to cut more than the proposed $33 billion, which would be the biggest in history, I guess, but said this was one step toward financial overhaul.
I'd like more, but, really this is kind of small ball compared to the big issues like the
sure.
debt limit. It's a $1.5 trillion deficit, so we've got to have to cut more next year. And we're also going to have to take our foot off the neck of the economy and get the private sector back to work so we can increase revenue into the Treasury at the same time and close that gap. So this is just a little piece of the puzzle.
Christian Freeland, how do you read this puzzle? Republicans, Democrats, Tea Party, we got a week to go before a shutdown deadline, we're told. What do you see unfolding, Christian?
Well, I would just like to very quickly inject maybe some economic reality into this debate about whether severe cuts to government spending in the United States right now
mm-hmm.
would have the kind of effect we've just heard described on stimulating revenue, stimulating the economy. And we don't have to think about predictions and forecasts to get an answer to that. We just need to look across the Atlantic at the United Kingdom, which followed, it was a Tea Party dream government approach,
right.
Severe austerity. And we have seen the economy shrinking even more swiftly than the government had predicted. So we know what the short-term impact would be. Now, some countries that are not lucky like the United States and are not able to borrow money cannot continue to spend when they have a fiscal situation like that of the United States. But America is really lucky. It can allow its economy to heal and to recover before dealing with its budget deficit problem, which is serious, but is a medium-term problem. All of this pressure to do it right now, when there is no wolf at the door, and when it could plunge, doing so could plunge America back into recession, to me is really Alice in Wonderland economics.
Huh. There's a view off the UK experience already. Jill Doherty, it seems as though Vice President Biden is in on these conversations, hovering around a $30 billion cut just in the balance of this fiscal year. It seems as though the White House is, in effect, though, buying into the process. Christia's afraid of its impact, but the Obama administration seems to be, you know, in the game.
Well, yeah, they are. But their usual modus operandi is not to be there, to let everybody do it. But, you know, I cover really foreign policy, and mm-hmm. I was looking at the kind of foreign policy implications of this, which are kind of interesting, that the perception among Americans is that a lot of the budget goes to foreign aid mm-hmm. and things like that. And when you look at what people are willing to have cut back, when you get to the really big numbers, you know, Medicare, Social Security, things like that, they're not willing to have them cut back. What they're willing to have cut back are the things like foreign aid, which really are peanuts compared to the rest of the budget. I mean, foreign aid is like 1% of the budget. But people think it is much more. In fact, some people, I've seen some numbers as much as around 20%. People believe the budget could be as much as 20% for foreign aid. Well, it's only 1%. So, you know, when the crunch comes, that's where people really have to decide the things that they like.
We've got politics and reality. They may be converging next week. Jill Doherty with CNN, Christia Freeland with Reuters, Jack Beatty, thank you so much to each of you. Our time is up here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.